Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's November 19th, 2010. At his home in Manhattan, Donald Longeal sits down at a table and opens up a new window in his computer's web browser. He runs a hand over his shaved head and clicks over to the website for the Wall Street Journal. Then he begins reading, catching himself up on everything happening in the world of finance. It's a world that Longeal knows well. He spent years working on Wall Street, and from 2008 to 2009, he was a portfolio manager for the hedge fund SAC Capital. It was a dream job, and Longeal made himself a very wealthy man. But things took a turn last April. Longeal hadn't been performing well on the job, and with his boss, Stephen Cohen, disappointed, eventually he was fired. These days, Longeal has been spending his time staying on top of financial news and searching for a new job. It's been a slow process. But tonight, as he scans the website for the Wall Street Journal, something catches his attention. There's an article with the headline, U.S. in Vast Insider Trading Probe. Longeal begins reading the story, which details a government crackdown on the financial industry. It appears to be a broad campaign. The Justice Department and the FBI and the SEC, several federal agencies, have all begun mobilizing to stop what the article describes as rampant insider trading across America's financial markets. As he reads, Longeal is filled with a feeling of suspense. It seems like the beginning of a sea change for the financial industry. If the government is leading an organized campaign to stop insider trading, Wall Street is going to be turned upside down. But then Longeal reads a paragraph that sends him into a panic. According to the story, the federal government is specifically targeting SAC Capital. For Longeal, it's terrible news. When he worked for SAC, his trades depended on inside information. Not only that, he kept extensive records of his tips, records that could now incriminate him. Longeal rises from the table and begins pacing the room. He's trying to get his life back on track, and in just 3 weeks, he's supposed to get married. He can't risk any kind of criminal charges. Longeal suddenly feels like he's drowning, gasping for air, and he realizes that right now there's only one thing that can solve his problems. He has to get rid of any evidence of wrongdoing and do it fast. Longeal hurries to the closet in the hallway. He tears through several drawers, looking for a set of external hard drives where his records are stored. As he rummages through his belongings, his fiancée steps into the room.
Don, what are you doing?
Hey, honey, could you give me a minute? I'll meet you back in the other room.
What's going on? Why are you tearing up the closet?
Longeal stops and turns to his fiancée.
Well, look, I have to be honest with you. There's a possibility I'm in trouble. Apparently the feds are cracking down on SAC.
But you don't work there anymore.
Well, that's true, but I still have my old records. These drives are full of information that came from insiders.
Insider trading?
Yeah.
Longeal returns to the closet and continues rummaging.
But Don, I don't understand. What are you doing?
That's my only option. I have to destroy everything.
But what if they find out? They won't find out. That's the point.
But we need to work fast.
No, what do you mean we?
I'm not getting involved.
If you care about me, then yeah, you're going to help me out.
This isn't an issue about me caring about you. This is about you getting involved in something illegal. You can't destroy evidence.
Longeal suddenly spots the hard drive.
Well, here we go. Okay, let's take care of this.
Don, don't do it.
Honey, listen to me. There's no other way.
Longeal walks the hard drives over to a table and sets them down. Then he grabs a pair of pliers.
I'm telling you, Don, don't get yourself in deeper trouble.
But it's too late now.
Using the pliers, Longeal begins ripping out the circuit boards, tearing them into small pieces. Longeal continues destroying the hard drives, losing track of time. And when he finally looks up at the clock, he sees it's 1:30 in the morning. Longeal sits back, exhausted. And as he catches his breath, he notices his fiancée standing in the corner with a tender look on her face. She says she can see he's in over his head, and she's had a change of heart. She'll help him with whatever he needs. Longeal smiles in relief, and soon he gathers the broken hard drives, and the two step out together into the cold New York night.
Out in the streets, he and his fiancée are looking for somewhere they can toss the evidence when suddenly there's a roar of a diesel engine. A garbage truck passes by, and Longiel doesn't hesitate. He throws the bag full of broken hard drives into the back of the truck and watches it as it disappears down the dark road. His eyes are bloodshot. His hands are shaky. But Longiel feels like he can let down his guard. It's done. His most immediate problem is taken care of. And while he doesn't know what the future might bring, one thing is clear. Everything is about to change on Wall Street. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In the late 2000s, government investigators began taking a closer look at hedge funds. These firms were renowned for producing outsized returns on their investments, with profits that seemed too good to be true. As they dug deeper, federal investigators learned that hedge funds were engaged in potentially criminal acts, including insider trading. The firms seemed to be getting access to lucrative information about companies, information that wasn't available to the public. While corruption like this appeared to be rampant throughout the industry, SAC Capital stood out among the pack. The high-flying hedge fund was run by billionaire Stephen Cohen, and as FBI agent BJ Kang continued his investigation, he got closer and closer to incriminating Cohen himself. This is Episode 3, Expert Networks. It's December 2010 in Boston, Massachusetts. BJ Kang leans against a parked car and looks out at the campus of a day school. It's a private all-girls academy with brick buildings and manicured lawns, a prep school for families with money. Kang checks his watch. Soon the school day is going to be over, and the students will come flooding out of the building. It'll be a frenzy of activity. Except Kang isn't here for any of the students. Kang is waiting for one of the teachers, a former Wall Street trader who could be a key asset for Kang's FBI investigation into hedge funds. And these days, Kang could use the help. He'd secured another informant, a former SAC Capital employee named C.B. Lee, and even set Lee up on a wiretapped call to Stephen Cohen. But Cohen must have somehow gotten wind that Lee was compromised, and soon he stopped answering Lee's phone calls. With few options to directly implicate Cohen, Kang had to go back to the drawing board. And that wasn't the end of his problems. Kang's investigation suffered a major setback after the Wall Street Journal ran a story detailing the FBI's work. The Bureau and other federal agencies have been trying to operate in secret. But when the story hit, they lost the upper hand. Every trader in finance now knew that the FBI might be coming for them and could take steps to cover their tracks. So Kang has been trying to quickly regain his footing. And if all goes well this afternoon,
he'll have himself a new informant. A few minutes later, school lets out, and children come pouring out onto the front lawn. Kang squints, looking through the crowd, when he spots his man. Noah Freeman carries a leather shoulder bag and wears a corduroy jacket. He used to be a trader with SAC Capital, but now he teaches economics at this private school. Kang approaches Freeman.
Hi, Mr. Freeman. I'd like to talk with you if you have a moment. Hello. I'm not sure we've met. Is your child in one of my classes? No, Mr. Freeman, I don't have any children at the school. I'm with the FBI.
Freeman's face goes pale.
I can't talk right now. I'm sorry. I'm very busy. I have homework to grade. Well, I do think you should put that on pause. Why don't we find somewhere to talk? I'm sorry, what is this all about? Expert networks. I have some questions I'm hoping you could answer. You want to talk right now? Well, that would be preferable. My car is parked right here. I only need a few minutes of your time.
Freeman hesitates, but finally he nods, and together he and Kang walk over to Kang's rental car. The two step inside, and when they're seated, Kang launches into it. Now, Mr. Freeman, in your time working as a securities trader at SAC Capital, did you ever use an expert network? From what I understand, these firms operate like a matchmaker of sorts. You pay them and they connect you with people inside companies.
Yeah, that's right. I used expert networks. It's common practice.
Okay. And how would you describe the quality of the information you'd get?
Well, I guess there's a reason they're called experts.
Let me ask another way. Let's say these experts offered you meaningful information that wasn't available to the public. Would you rely on that information when making a trade?
Well, that kind of trading would be illegal.
It would be. So let me play you something. Kang takes out his laptop and clicks over to a sound file. He turns up the volume and hits play.
Hey, Winnie, it's Noah. You still free to talk about semiconductors?
Kang hits stop and turns back to Freeman. What he just played was the beginning of a taped phone call in which Freeman got inside information from one of his paid experts. It's a potentially incriminating piece of evidence.
Agent Kang, am I under arrest?
Well, that depends. We listened to the tapes and you sounded like a man we might be able to trust.
Oh, you're asking me to be an informant.
Yeah, help us. Cooperate with the FBI. You'd avoid dragging your family through the mud. You'd salvage your reputation. And that matters, right, when you teach at an elite private school?
Freeman looks down as he considers the options. For Kang, these are some of the most electric moments of the job. A potential source deciding whether to flip. The investigation hangs in the balance. When Freeman looks back up, he exhales, and then he nods. He'll cooperate. Soon, Freeman steps out of the car, and Kang shoots off a text message to his partner. Round one was a victory. Now they have to get ready for round two, an interview with Freeman that's on the record. It could be a gold mine, giving them exactly what they need to go after Stephen Cohen. A few days later, FBI agent BJ Kang sits down at a conference table in New York City. Across from him sits Noah Freeman, the former stock trader for SAC Capital and Kang's newest informant. For Kang, this is a positive development. Freeman is following through on his promise. He's offered to speak on the record about his time at Stephen Cohen's hedge fund, and he appears ready to speak candidly about the firm's culture and its dependence on insider trading. Kang knows this could be a breakthrough conversation, one the FBI and the Department of Justice badly need. So far, they haven't been able to directly implicate Stephen Cohen for insider trading. The founder of SAC Capital seems to have designed his hedge fund so that he never directly signs off on any criminal behavior. He only encourages insider trading and looks the other way when it takes place. But with Freeman's cooperation, Kang could secure proof that Cohen knowingly engaged in criminal acts and that the problem was pervasive across the hedge fund. Kang turns on a recorder and looks up at Freeman, ready to dive in. But Freeman is flanked by a pair of attorneys, and he may be hesitant at first. So Kang starts with some softball questions. He asks about Freeman's background, the name of his wife, the different analysts he collaborated with over the years. But after the initial round of questioning, Kang can feel the momentum start to shift. He knows he can't delay the hard questions much longer. So he pivots and begins asking about Freeman's own experience with insider trading. Kang is expecting pushback from Freeman and his lawyers, but he's surprised by what happens next.
The former trader begins freely discussing how he relied on inside information while executing trades. He describes his sources at companies like Cisco, the technology firm. And Freeman explains that he didn't hoard the information. He and another trader, Donald Longjuel, shared inside information that each of them had acquired. It was a way to help out a fellow trader at SAC Capital. Kang is shocked by the admission. Freeman and Longjuel were close friends. Longjuel was even the best man at Freeman's wedding. If this had been a case involving the mafia, a source like Freeman would never have ratted out his best friend. It would have been a breach of loyalty. But the more he learns, the more Kang realizes that Wall Street criminals have an entirely different code of conduct. Kang presses forward, emboldened, and asks more specifically about Stephen Cohen and what he expected from his traders. Again, Freeman doesn't hesitate. He explains that it all came down to a simple idea. You were expected to provide your best trading ideas to Cohen. And as Freeman understood it, that meant giving Cohen inside information. Kang feverishly jots down a series of notes. This conversation couldn't be going any better. Because whether or not Cohen explicitly asked for inside information, it's clear that he expected it, and that insider trading is a pillar of SAC Capital. Still, to build the case, Kang knows he needs more than just one man's interpretation of the events. So he asks Freeman whether other traders at SAC Capital saw things the same way. Freeman grows adamant. He says he wasn't the only one. He never was. Traders at SAC know the score. Steve Cohen wanted edge. He wanted the best information. He might not ask where the traders got it, but traders knew that if you wanted to impress Steve, and if you wanted to hit your numbers, you had to play dirty. It was that simple. Kang finishes jotting down his notes. And for what seems like the first time in weeks, he feels optimistic. He now has a former trader from SAC Capital pointing his finger at Stephen Cohen, arguing that Cohen encourages illegal trading. It's a damaging portrait of both the hedge fund and its founder. And Kang knows that while there's no smoking gun evidence here, it's enough to keep the investigation moving forward while keeping Steve Cohen in his crosshairs. It's early summer 2011. BJ Kang walks into the offices of the Securities and Exchange Commission in New York City. The SEC is the primary federal agency responsible for policing Wall Street. And as Kang steps into a meeting with several colleagues, he knows that the government now has a major case on its hands. Kang has spearheaded a wide-reaching investigation, gathering evidence from former employees of SAC Capital, as well as other insiders on Wall Street. And the takeaway is clear. SAC Capital appears to be engaging in widespread insider trading. At this point, Kang has no doubt that the government should go after SAC and its founder, Steve Cohen. But there is still a hitch. No one has been able to find direct evidence proving without a doubt that Cohen explicitly ordered his employees to commit crimes. Without that, Cohen could deny responsibility. So as Kang takes a seat at the table, he glances at his colleagues from across the federal government. They include prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office, representatives from the SEC. And Kang is hoping that with all of their collaboration so far, somewhere, someone has found that silver bullet, something proving that Cohen is culpable. A young SEC lawyer named Charles Riley begins the conversation. He asks Kang if he remembers something that came through one of his wiretaps, a pharmaceutical trade that seemed too good to be true. Kang nods, of course he remembers. SAC made a huge profit a few years back, trading stock for a couple pharmaceutical companies. Apparently, a lot of employees at SAC Capital were buzzing about the trades, but there was still a lot Kang didn't know about what had happened. But SEC lawyer Riley has learned a few things. He begins laying out the chain of events. It seems that in the summer of 2008, SAC Capital sold off enormous holdings in two companies, Wyeth and Elan. 2 days later, the stock prices for both companies plummeted. By selling off their shares right in the nick of time, the hedge fund protected itself from a major loss. Kang nods. So far, it does smell like something rotten. The SEC might have had some kind of warning in advance, but it's circumstantial so far. Riley says he agrees, but Kang needs to know a key piece of information. At the time, the two companies were developing a new Alzheimer's drug. A doctor named Sid Gilman was one of the chief researchers leading that trial. And records show that Gilman had extensive contact with a trader at SAC.
and was paid handsomely to be a consultant for the hedge fund. Kang starts to smirk. It's adding up. The doctor had access to the results of the drug trial. He must have then tipped off a trader, telling him that the Alzheimer's drug wasn't a success. The hedge fund then pulled out right at the last minute, saving itself a huge loss. It's a clear case of insider trading. The SEC lawyer smiles, saying it got worse. SEC Capital didn't only protect itself against a loss, it used the information to make a big profit. Stephen Cohen didn't just sell off the stock they owned. They shorted the company's stocks, placing a bet that their share prices would go down. In the end, he made a profit of more than $250 million. Kang is nearly speechless. This is what they've been looking for, proof of insider trading directly connected to Stephen Cohen. If Cohen shorted stocks based on illegal information, he likely committed a crime himself, one he could be prosecuted for. Kang rises from his seat and gathers his papers. The meeting has been incredibly helpful, but now he knows what he has to do, and he has to move fast. Kang has to hop on a plane and travel to Ann Arbor, Michigan. That's where this doctor, Sid Gilman, works as a researcher and professor. Kang is going to have to confront him in person before any of this leaks. He'll lay on some thick pressure and reveal that the doctor engaged in a criminal act. Kang knows that Gilman will cave. He's a professor, not a hardened criminal. And when he does finally crack, Kang is sure that the FBI will have their smoking gun. Irrefutable proof that SAC Capital and Steve Cohen have broken the law. American Scandal is sponsored by BetterHelp. I'm an introvert when there's not a microphone in front of me. People drain me. Even the smallest interactions, like ordering a pizza or calling a plumber, are taxing. And I know I avoid socializing sometimes because it's just so tiresome. But it's also delightful, a connection I crave, and that's a conundrum I'm still working on. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And as the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless search for a therapist. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/AS today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/AS. American Scandal is sponsored by the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office. Following one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British legal history, the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office, is based on the shocking true story of the British Post Office scandal. When money started to seemingly disappear from local branches, the government-owned post office wrongly blamed their own managers for its apparent loss. And for more than a decade, hundreds were accused of theft and fraud. Many were even sent to prison, leaving lives, marriages, and reputations in ruins. But the issue was actually caused by errors in the post office's own computer system, something it denied for years. Don't miss Mr. Bates vs. the Post Office, starring Toby Jones, beginning Sunday, April 7th on Masterpiece on PBS. The series will be available to stream on the PBS app, PBS Masterpiece Prime Video Channel, and PBS.org. It's a cool morning in September of 2011. FBI agent BJ Kang and his partner are waiting in a car on a residential street near the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. They're parked and staking out the home of a doctor and researcher named Sid Gilman. Any minute now, the neurologist should walk out his front door and begin making his way to work. As the two FBI agents wait for Gilman to step out, Kang reviews the game plan for today. He and his partner are going to confront Gilman. They're going to accuse him of participating in insider trading while consulting for SAC Capital. And if all goes to plan, they'll convince Gilman to give up the truth, providing incriminating details about the hedge fund. And soon enough, an older man with white hair steps out of the house and closes the front door. Kang knows that it's Gilman, a professor at the university and one of the head researchers working on a clinical trial for an Alzheimer's drug. Gilman walks down the front steps and then gets in his car and pulls out of the driveway. Kang turns on the ignition of his own car. Then he pulls out into the road and begins following Gilman, turning through leafy and quiet residential streets. A few minutes later, Gilman takes another turn, pulls into the parking lot for the University of Michigan Hospital. Kang pulls up beside him and parks. And when Gilman steps out, Kang and his partner make the approach.
Excuse me, Dr. Gilman? Yes, can I help you? My name's BJ Kang. I'm an agent with the FBI. The FBI? That's right. My partner and I focus on financial crimes, and we'd like to speak with you.
Gilman's eyes dart left and right.
Dr. Gilman, we need to speak with you about your involvement with the Alzheimer's drug bapineuzumab. Specifically, any conversations you might have had about the drug with a portfolio manager at SAC Capital, Matthew Martoma. Well, I'm sorry, I'm afraid I can't be of much help. And why is that? Well, truthfully, I don't remember much from that time. Dr. Gilman, we're here because we believe insider trading laws have been broken. We believe Martoma made investment decisions based on confidential information that you supplied. Well, again, I don't know what you're talking about. I never gave Matthew any confidential information.
Kang knows that Gilman is lying, so he doesn't feel wrong bluffing and telling a small lie himself.
Dr. Gilman, we have taped conversations. You taped us? We have you on tape giving Martoma inside information. No, you're mistaken. This is a mix-up. Now, please, excuse me. Dr. Gilman, let me be perfectly clear. We know you told Matthew Martoma about the drug trial. No, that's not true. You gave confidential information to a trader at a hedge fund. And I'm telling you, I never did. Now, please, excuse me. I need to get to work.
Gilman begins to walk away, and so Kang decides to take another angle.
Dr. Gilman, I want you to think about what you could be giving up. You have a reputation. You're an expert in your field, a respected professor. You don't have to end your career. You don't have to self-destruct like this. But in order to protect yourself, you have to tell the truth.
Gilman pauses, his head lowered, and rubs his eyes. He looks tired, like a man who's lost many nights of sleep grappling with the weight of his own decisions. And finally, he looks back at Kang.
If you really believe that I shared confidential information and you have tapes of my calls, then it's likely I did. But I didn't mean to. Now, I don't remember what I told him exactly. It was 3 years ago. Dr. Gilman, thank you. I understand your position. Now, when you're ready to talk a little more, I want you to be aware of something. In all of this, you're only a grain of sand, and so is Martoma. The person we're really after is Stephen Cohen.
Gilman nods, understanding the implication. The FBI doesn't want to go after him. He's not the target, and if he cooperates, his life wouldn't be ruined. After taking it all in, Gilman says he needs some time. He has to think. And as he walks away, Kang and his partner exchange a glance. The interrogation wasn't a slam dunk by any means, but the first contact almost never is. It does take time and patience to develop a source. And if what the professor admitted is any indication, he may become a valuable informant. But that could take a while. And in the meantime, Kang needs to keep pressing forward. So for now, that means going to Florida, where Kang now has the ammunition to confront Matthew Martoma, the traitor who groomed the doctor and managed to secure valuable inside information from him. 2 months later, BJ Kang stands under the moonlight of Boca Raton. The air in southeast Florida is humid and sticky, and for Kang, it feels like time has come to a stop. In front of him is a Spanish-style mansion, the kind of house made possible by Wall Street money and insider trading, which was what brought Kang to Florida. He's been building a case against the hedge fund SAC Capital. Now, Kang has come to Florida to interrogate Matthew Martoma, the former trader at SAC who acquired inside information about an Alzheimer's drug and then passed that information to the head of SAC, Stephen Cohen. It was information that Cohen then used to make a fortune. But as he stands in the muggy nighttime air, Kang stares blankly for a moment. The events unfolding in front of him are completely disorienting. Minutes ago, he confronted Martoma on his front doorstep and accused him of insider trading. Martoma's eyes then became glassy, and he fainted and collapsed. Martoma is still lying on the ground, his eyes closed. Kang is about to snap into action and do something when there's a scream as Martoma's wife comes running toward them. Alert once again, Kang turns, asking Martoma's wife if she'd like to call an ambulance. She shakes her head and says no, because she's a doctor. She can take care of this. So for several minutes, Martoma's wife tends to her husband, as Kang and his partner look on with concern. Kang hopes it wasn't some kind of stroke. But soon, Martoma's eyes flutter open. He pushes himself slowly off the ground, and with his body unsteady, Martoma takes a deep breath and tells Kang that he can keep talking. He's not going to try and worm his way out of a conversation with the FBI. Kang nods. It's an unusual set of circumstances, but he's come too far to walk away. So he repeats the accusation he made just moments ago. He knows about Martoma's insider trading. And he knows what happened with the pharmaceutical companies in 2008. Martoma holds himself against the wall, grimacing, and then exchanges a look with his wife. No one has to say a word. It's clear that everyone knows the story, how Martoma got inside information and how he fed it to his boss, Stephen Cohen. But for a moment, Martoma remains silent. Kang has seen this a million times before. A man confronted with the facts of his crime, that moment of hesitation before he's willing to tell the truth. Kang also knows how to reel people in, flip them so they become cooperators. So he reminds Martoma of the consequences of his crime. He could go to prison. His life could be over. He could do permanent damage to his children. Or, Kang says, Martoma could cooperate. At the mention of cooperation, Martoma looks again at his wife. She's shaking and obviously rattled by the situation. Kang decides to level with Martoma. He admits that Martoma's not the target. They're mainly going after his old boss, Stephen Cohen. But if Martoma wants to protect himself, he has to talk. Taking one last glance at his wife, Martoma says he does want to help, but he's going to have to speak to a lawyer first. Kang nods. Once again, he made incremental progress with a potential informant. They almost never flip after the first conversation. But for now, he'll take this as a sign that Martoma will eventually cooperate. And using his testimony, Kang will finally be able to take on the founder of SAC Capital, Stephen Cohen. It's late March 2012 in Los Angeles. In a luxury hotel, Stephen Cohen stands by a tall window, watching the sun setting over downtown. The day is coming to a close, and Cohen should get back to what he does best, researching the markets, charting the course for his hedge fund. But Cohen's mind is far from the world of finance. He came to Los Angeles with a single mission. He's planning to buy the Dodgers, the city's baseball team. Cohen has always loved the sport, and owning a major league team has been a lifelong goal. And now that Cohen is worth billions, he can afford the hefty price tag of a major sports franchise. Still, buying the Dodgers isn't just some vanity project. For Cohen, it's a way to prove to himself that he's still in control, that he can lead the life he wants, even as larger, more powerful forces have begun to mobilize against him. Cohen turns from the window and pours himself a drink. It's been a hard few months. The federal government has continued its bruising investigation into hedge funds. Several employees of SAC Capital have been charged with insider trading, and one of Cohen's current employees was arrested by the FBI just 2 months ago. On top of all that, Cohen himself was recently subpoenaed by the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's now legally obligated to answer questions about his business with the clear implication that the government is considering charges. With so many clouds hanging over his head, Cohen is hungry for a big and clear win. Nothing would be sweeter than owning a Major League Baseball team. Cohen's cell phone rings. It's one of his associates, who might have news about Cohen's bid for the Dodgers, so he picks up. The associate announces that the decision is in. Cohen put in a serious bid, $1.6 billion, but there's bad news. The league decided to go with another buyer. Cohen slumps into a chair, defeated. He had his heart set on this. What happened? The associate explains that the league went with the group teamed up with Magic Johnson. Johnson's a legendary basketball player and former Los Angeles Laker. He's beloved in the city, and on top of that, his investment team put in a higher bid. It's that simple. Cohen shakes his head. He knows it isn't simple. He could have been asked to counter, offer more money. But this was never about dollars. It was about optics. Cohen runs a hedge fund that's facing legal scrutiny and accusations of insider trading. Major League Baseball never would have wanted Cohen as an owner of the team. So Cohen hangs up and pours himself another drink. As he looks out over the dark skyline, he realizes it's time to get back to the East Coast. That's where he belongs, and that's where he needs to start fighting back. Because by now, Cohen has taken too many punches from the government. They've tarnished his reputation, turned him into a pariah. The Dodgers should have been his. But this smear campaign won't go on forever. As soon as he gets home, Cohen's going to take action. He's going to find a way to strike back and make sure that this government investigation comes to an end.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? like every single time you look at your bank account, honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
It's April 2012 in a federal building in Manhattan. Stephen Cohen walks into the offices of the Security and Exchange Commission, the agency that polices Wall Street. He takes a seat at a wide conference table, and adjusting his tailored suit, Cohen quickly sizes up the room. Across the table is a group of attorneys from the SEC. A couple of them look young, and Cohen can't help but wonder if this is the first time they've seen any action. It's all a good sign, because in just a few minutes, Cohen is going to begin a deposition, giving legal testimony under oath about his hedge fund SEC capital. It's all part of a federal investigation, one that's produced a lot of bad press for Cohen. And with that press, Cohen has had to field panic phone calls from investors who've been watching the news like everyone else. But Cohen isn't too concerned. It's not just that he's got one of the best legal teams in the country, corporate attorneys who are much more experienced than these government lawyers sitting in front of him. But Cohen also has a winning strategy. He agreed to cooperate with the SEC, and that gives the appearance that he has nothing to hide, that his investors have no need to panic. At the same time, in this deposition, Cohen is going to employ the same trick he learned years ago, back when he had his first showdown with the SEC. He's going to stonewall and methodically shut down their questioning. In the conference room, the prosecutor Charles Riley opens a thick binder and begins paging through notes.
Okay. And now we're on the record here, so... This is the deposition of Stephen Cohen. Before we begin, Mr. Cohen, do you understand that you are under oath?
I do, but before we get going, I've got a question myself.
Okay, go ahead.
How long is this going to take?
Here's the thing. I got seats to a Knicks game tonight, and I don't want to miss it.
I'm sorry?
The Knicks. Basketball, New York?
Riley pauses, looking bewildered, and Cohen represses a smile. That was intentional. He wanted to throw off the other side right from the start and assert himself as the one leading the conversation.
Well, don't worry about it. Not everyone's a basketball fan, right? So what are we talking about?
Mr. Cohen, I'd like to discuss Matthew Martoma, your former employee.
Matthew? Yeah, he used to work for me.
And how would you rate his performance back when he was at SEC Capital?
Honestly, I can't remember.
Well, let's go back to the start. Do you remember hiring him?
No, I'm drawing a blank. I'm sorry.
And you don't remember what he was like as a trader?
Again, it's all pretty hazy. I mean, you have to understand, I've got a big workforce.
Riley blinks as he glances at his paperwork. Cohen represses another smile. So far, so good.
Okay, Mr. Cohen. Well, let's talk about Elon and Wyeth, the two companies developing a new Alzheimer's drug. SAC Capital took a sizable position in the companies. What led you to take such a large gamble?
Well, if I remember right, Matthew was confident in the investment.
And why was he so confident?
Specifically?
Yes, please, give us specifics.
I'm sorry, but I don't recall exactly.
Mr. Cohen, we're talking something like $1 billion of your firm's money. And you don't remember why you gave that order a green light?
Believe me, guys, I wish I could. Probably a good lesson for the future, right?
Okay, let's flash forward to July of 2008. You gave an order to sell all of the shares of the two companies. And you did so after this.
Riley places a printout of an email on the table.
Martoma emailed you with this message. Is there a good time to catch up with you this morning? It's important. Did the two of you talk? And if so, what did you discuss?
I remember him saying that he was getting uncomfortable with the position.
Did he explain why?
Yeah, she might have. I'm sorry, I just don't remember.
For the next few hours, Cohen continues to dodge question after question, offering blank stares and the excuse of faulty memory. And with each evasion, he sees the SEC attorneys grow more and more agitated and more impatient. Finally, at 6 o'clock, the deposition comes to an end. Cohen and his legal team rise from the table, and they begin making their way out of the SEC's offices. When they're back in the cool night air, Cohen and his lawyers exchange a look of victory. By coming in to testify, Cohen signaled to his investors that he had nothing to hide. And by stonewalling the prosecution, Cohen helped protect himself and SEC capital. It's a win-win. And for Cohen, a sign that all of his problems will soon be a thing of the past. About a year later, in the offices of SAC Capital, Stephen Cohen sits down with his attorney, Martin Klotz. Pale winter light is streaming through the windows, and as the two lean back on a pair of couches, Cohen begins to digest what could be a difficult suggestion. Although Cohen thought his deposition with the SEC had been a success, his legal problems haven't gone away. The government has continued to mount a campaign against Cohen's hedge fund, both in the press and in courtrooms. Federal prosecutors even filed criminal charges against Matthew Martoma. They've accused him of insider trading in a case involving Martoma's investments in two pharmaceutical companies developing a drug for Alzheimer's. Cohen had hoped his legal troubles would be gone by now, but it's clear that this was wishful thinking. So today, he and his lawyer need to figure out a new course of action. Klotz, the attorney, takes a sip of coffee and launches into it. Matthew Martoma's arrest and criminal charges have put Cohen in a difficult place. And with so much negative spotlight on the hedge fund, Cohen could be looking at some very real and very long-term damage. It's time to make a move. Cohen nods. It's true that with the arrest of Matthew Martoma, Cohen and his hedge fund have taken a reputational hit. And if Martoma flips, things could get worse. So Cohen asks his lawyer what he has in mind. Klotz takes another sip of coffee. Then, speaking carefully, he tells Cohen that he believes it's time to settle. Cohen stares at his attorney in disbelief. He doesn't understand. What is there to settle? Klotz reminds Cohen of everything he's up against. The SEC is still investigating his hedge fund. If they keep digging, they may find something that could destroy Cohen and his firm. But if Cohen agrees to a settlement now and admits some fault, he could head off any future problems. Cohen shakes his head. It's a bitter proposition. Any settlement would be an admission of guilt. But Klotz reminds Cohen that he shouldn't think in terms of guilt and innocence. It's just strategy and self-interest. And right now, Cohen's self-interest lies in a settlement. He'll agree that SAC Capital made some illegal trades. He'll pay a fine. And then the problems go away. Cohen rubs his hands over his face, weighing the decision. After a moment, he asks what exactly it would cost to get the government off his back. Klotz says it won't be cheap. $500 million. At the mention of such an enormous sum of money, Cohen breaks out in laughter. It's unthinkable. He could fight the charges, and even with an army of expensive lawyers, he'd still come out ahead. But Klotz pleads with Cohen to listen to reason. $500 million is nothing to a firm like SAC, and if that makes the problems go away, he'll recoup the money in no time. Cohen stares at Klotz, thinking back to his failed bid for the LA Dodgers. Settling feels like losing, and Cohen hates losing. But he also hates everyone thinking he's a criminal. All the public speculation, the laughter behind his back at parties and social gatherings. It's a terrible feeling. And the more he thinks about it, the more Cohen likes the idea of writing a check and putting an end to the whole thing. Cohen stands and tells his lawyer that he's right. If $500 million is what it's going to take, then Klotz should get those wheels spinning. Cohen doesn't want to spend another afternoon having to dodge questions from government attorneys. He's better than that. And Klotz is right. $500 million is chump change for SAC Capital. He'll make it back in no time at all. So that's the plan. Cohen is going to settle. He'll write a check and get back to work. And as long as he continues to do what he does best, Cohen will keep building SAC Capital into the most dominant hedge fund on Wall Street. From Wondery, this is episode 3 of the FBI versus the hedge fund from American Scandal. In our next episode, the SEC and the Justice Department put the finishing touches on their case against Stephen Cohen, and former SAC Capital employees have to decide whether to take the stand against their old boss.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to American Scandal ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about Stephen Cohen and SAC Capital, we recommend the book Black Edge by Sheila Kolhatkar. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by George Ducker, edited by Christina Malzberger. Our senior producer is Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.